Anias Tipker, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Well, this is an important week, and you're here to talk with us about the rally scheduled for this Thursday at the Capitol in Salem to push Governor Brown to stop the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and frac gas pipeline in southern Oregon, a project that the state will be making its final decision on in terms of their permits in late January. First, Anias, tell us what the Jordan Cove project is and the extent of it, and then why it's so worrisome that this even could have gone this far.
Yeah. So the Jordan Cove project is really, it's easy to think about it as two pieces. There's the actual export facility, which would be built in Coos Bay, and that's the name of it is Jordan Cove, and that would be exporting fossil fuels to the Asia for use in Asian markets. The other piece of it is a pipeline across southern Oregon. And that pipeline goes across the lands of private landowners. It goes across federal lands. It crosses hundreds of waterways. It goes across lands that tribal communities have rights to. So when we're talking about this facility, there's both a piece of thinking about the impact that exporting these fossil fuels to the world will have on our climate. There's also a piece that's very important about the dangers to us here in Oregon because of impacts on land and water and on people's rights, people's property rights, community property rights. And what's interesting is that we have very few mechanisms to actually fight this project legally based on the impact it's going to have on the climate, right?
That's why there's so much focus on the immediate impact on health, the potential for leaks.
Yeah. I mean, the immediate impacts are very, the risks are very real. So they're serious, too.
Because these pipes do inevitably leak. And
they do
have their own emissions, even if they're running properly.
Are
invasive in many ways. But even if these pipes could be secured in a way that prevented any leaks, it would still be a bad idea because it's a bad product that staggering in its impact.
Exactly, because we're at the point where we absolutely cannot be persisting with the burning of fossil fuels, with the extraction of fossil fuels. And so, you know, anything that expands those markets rather than looking to how we can find other energy sources, how we can reduce the production of petrochemical products, because that's actually another piece of this, is how the products would probably be used for making plastics. It's the wrong direction. It's the wrong direction for us to be spending even a penny of government money, of our money.
And in fact, we should invest in undoing these things that are already there. But I think that itself suggests how, what a big octopus, it's more than a snake, an octopus that has tentacles all over the place and interlocking pipelines and terminals, and it can be staggering in the scope of it and where all this stuff comes from.
Well, yeah, that's both a very nice way for you to get me out of my blunder, but it's true that often, I mean, that is how we have to approach this, as a network of pipelines and projects that are all seeking outlets.
Yeah.
And so it is entirely possible that, you know, a project that is intended, a line that is intended for one use, could be used for other things. So our solidarity in fighting these projects has to be very strong as well, because there's really, there, you know, we talk about the thin green line of this region, and it's really true that we have to work together in California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia to stop all of these export facilities.
And that thin green line refers to all along the Pacific coast, the
resistance. Yeah, it's the term that's come up in recent years for what
Barbara
we're doing.
Bernstein has a radio documentary on that. So why has Governor Brown, who presents herself as a champion of of responding to climate change. Why has she been so resistive? I mean, she's on a big committee on land use, right?
That's right. She's on the land use board.
And she's the governor. And there are she has a lot of support in the scientific reviews, environmental reviews of this project so far, which have raised enormous red flags about its impacts.
Over 200 pages of critiques and, you know, from state agencies identifying problems. And one thing we didn't mention is that the federal government, so there's an interplay between federal and state approvals, and the federal government released its report last Friday recommending that the project be approved. This is not at all surprising because the FERC, as it's called, often
the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Yes, that often it's kind of a rubber stamp agency, and especially under the current administration. So even though there were all of these critiques and a number of crucial areas of mitigation were not spelled out at all in that environmental review, you know, basically the review saying there are problems here, but it's going to be possible to mitigate them, so let's not take them too seriously, without actually giving the details. That's the kind of review that they issued and recommended for approval. So that's the federal piece. But there are state permissions that need to be given. And as you mentioned, Governor Brown is on the land use board. So she has the authority to step in and stop this.
You know, and apparently this would be the largest single contributor to carbon emissions or warming in the state, and pretty much negate anything else that's being done. I mean, it's staggering in the impact of this project.
Yes.
Any sane person.
Right. So if you're looking and thinking about what's going to be our long-term impact, then you have to think that this project is out of line with everything else that we might be trying to do. And just as you say, it would cancel out any other impacts. But, you know, to your question, why Governor Brown hasn't done this, we don't know. We are truly, I think, in the community, truly mystified why she hasn't stepped up and used her authority. She says she's a climate champion. That's why we're having this rally.
Why wear red? Although that, you explain it. Why we're wearing red?
Red has just become the color. It's sort of interesting that we have a thin green line, but we wear red, so we wear red.
And the indigenous.
There's also because of indigenous, red being associated with indigenous communities
and indigenous resistance gatherings. And I think it's interesting too that there is resistance all along the thin green line up to British Columbia, and actually the gas that's expected to come in to Jordan Cove is from tribal lands in Fort mm-hmm. John, BC. Mm-hmm. And that there's resistance by First Nations groups throughout Canada to the extraction and transport of this product. So along this web of this vast and lethal infrastructure is also a parallel web of resistance.
Yes.
That we're part of here and beyond.
Yes,
what about the local resistance to this project in Coos Bay and that area?
There's tremendous local resistance, and there has been for a long time. And that's the thing to remember as well. This project there's been such resistance and such evidence about the negative impacts of this project. It has been killed twice before. This is the third go-round.
At the permit.
Yes,
process.
At the permitting level. And actually, even once before, the FERC even denied a permit, which kind of just, you know, recommended against approving it.
And the
which
company
really
just
shows
took another go at it.
With the changes at the federal level, the company was encouraged absolutely by this administration to go ahead and give it another go. And so that's what we're dealing with now. But I just want to point out that, like, when we talk about local resistance, it has been going on for over a decade with people on the ground really standing strong, both some of the tribal communities really advocating for an understanding of how this will impact waterways, which are crucial to their cultural life and to the health of everyone in the region. Because if there's a spill, it impacts can impact everyone. But even if there's not a spill, because of the changes that are done, you're killing trees, you have to clear areas, that changes the temperature of the water. There's very like complex but easily documented mechanisms that come into play.
In terms of the effects on the whole ecosystem.
Right, right. And a lot of that's available on the internet, actually, if I could think of it. There's beautiful work that I think Rogue Climate and some of the other groups working in Southern Oregon have put together. You can go look this up and understand it in a really easy way.
I think it's also important in terms of assumptions that rural people are all conservative, reactionary, and there's wonderful rural organizing going on around this issue.
And the landowners, there are over 90 landowners who are publicly opposing this, who have not given permission, who have said they will fight this every step of the way. And they are personally... They have turned down very large offers of money to be able to use their land. So they are taking a stand saying, no, we know this is not right. And it's really coming at a cost to them, at an actual financial cost, and the cost of this energy, of, you know, being in conflict in your community sometimes. So the people in Southern Oregon who are fighting this are really dedicated to it. And we need to stand with them.
The 350 PDX has also been involved in bringing environmental racism, in making that central to the climate movement. And this is one example of how climate change affects minority and indigenous communities more profoundly. And if people are already vulnerable in some way through their health or... poverty makes people more vulnerable to these effects. Can you say more about how your organization is addressing this and perhaps using the recent ballot measure that was passed last fall? 350 PDX was on the steering committee of the Portland Clean Energy Fund that passed last fall. Just in closing, how did that fund and what are the hopes for that addressing the inequality and racial injustice, right?
That's a lot. That's a lot in closing.
But it was part of the campaign, right?
It absolutely was. And so I'll just really quickly say part of what made the Portland Clean Energy Initiative so groundbreaking was that climate groups and other groups here in town really followed the lead of our communities of color in outlining what the problem was and what the solutions needed to be. And then we were able to come together around that. And I think, you know, with this fight in Southern Oregon, it's been very important to listen to people on the ground, whether that's tribal communities that understand the impacts on the animals and the land and the water, understand it better than anyone, listening to them to find solutions, and also listening to people who are economically impacted, the landowners and people, you know, for whom this is put forward as a short-term economic solution that would make life easier in the short term, but they're standing strong and saying, no, this is not the future for us.
So where do people gather? And just give us, in closing, a few details, and we'll post it. I assume there's more details on the 350 PDX.
Yeah, we'll have details on our website, which is 350pdx.org. It's this Thursday is the rally. It's a big rally at the state capitol. November 21st, 11 to 1. We will have a bus to go down from 350 PDX. So if you want to come to our office at 9 a.m., you can get a ride on that bus. And our office is at Central Lutheran Church. Just look us up. It's in Northeast. I'll put the address online.
Okay, and wear red. But if you don't have anything red, you're still welcome to be there. We need to have our voices and our presence there to let the governor know how we feel about this.
That's right.
Thank you so much
for
being with us today. Anais Tipker with 350 PDX.
Thanks very much for having me.